I'm in the Abbey House bar in the village of Four in Westmead. The door is open and the sun is streaming in. And the owner, Beatrice Coffey, or Beezy, is telling me about the night two men had an unusual chat about something called the burying of the sheaf.
The night that I heard the discussion going on here about this man asking him, this other man about the burying of the sheaf, I nearly collapsed. Like, I couldn't believe it. Like, you know, I was really annoyed, you know.
Now, a sheaf, or a sheaf, is a bundle of oat stalks with the grain still on their tops. And I'm dying to know why talking about a sheaf of oats could be so upsetting for Beezy. So I asked her if she could tell me the whole story.
I can. I wonder, should I?
Why?
Some of them people are alive today.
Hmm.
Oh, sure, I'll tell you some of it. I didn't mention any names or anything. If you wanted to curse somebody, you made a doll out of this, the sheaf of oats, and you seemingly stuck needles in all the joints of it, and you buried it, and you seemingly prayed over it.
And as it rotted in the ground, apparently strange things happened to the person for whom this doll-like sheaf was buried.
It was buried for a man up the road here, not so very far away, a good few years ago. And sure, himself, he got a heart attack, and his wife and all his children, them all ended up in hospital. Everything around the house, everything died, like, you know, like all his cattle and cows, he used to milk a heap of cows, and everything dropped dead, just dropped dead, like.
I don't quite know why I'm so instantly captivated by Beezy's story. I think it's because I recognise some deep truth in it. From a time where we knew for certain that elements of the natural world had great power within them. Or at least, believing that idea helped us understand the wonder of the natural world.
Was this long ago?
Well, I suppose it could be 20 years ago, I suppose, like.
You're listening to part 4 of the A to Z of Ireland, an alphabetical journey through this country's natural wonders. And tonight, it's all about people and the way we relate to nature.
You plant 7 acres of oats and linseed. The birds eat them all winter. So it's giving something back.
I think it's a myth that we can't feed the world from natural resources.
Yeah. On the previous leg of this journey, we jumped into Kay for kayaks and burrowed in under the earth's surface, looking through crevices in the Irish coastline. Finishing up with O for the wonderful and overlooked tradition of rolling in the May Day dew. Tonight we pick up the trail with P for people of the past. And I'm on my way to visit a museum in Castlebar, County Mayo, that celebrates the humble, wholesome ways our recent ancestors lived with and related to their natural heritage.
I remember the first 2 times I came to Mayo, I was really interested in getting to see the Museum of Country Life. Like, imagine, I know we've all our big museums in Dublin, full of gold torques and, you know, carved stone carvings and beautiful jewellery. But then I suddenly saw that the National Museum has a museum about country life, about all the art and the crafts and the majesty that is just humbly found in farmyards and in old houses and villages. I thought, I want to see that place. And if all of these are gathered in this one building, it could be a sort of an insight into how humankind on this island used to work in tandem with nature.
So I'm here to meet one of the curators, Clodagh Doyle.
Hi, nice to meet you, I'm Clodagh.
And she immediately leads me to their storage area. She wants to show me some of the thousands of artefacts that reveal the simplicity and complexity of Irish rural life.
So we're in... Are we underground now in the archive stores?
We're on
the stores of the Museum of Country Life background. And each is just movable racks full of different crafts.
We're in what looks like a warehouse, though a well-built and insulated one.
I find this the most inspiring space.
There are literally dozens of enormous metal cupboards.
And just even the titles, Boats, Fishing and Hunting, Trades and Crafts.
They're all on rails, and you can move them like train carriages by turning a sort of steering wheel.
Now,
The cupboards are far taller than me, and each has double doors that open onto an array of carefully boxed and catalogued items.
Look at these. Straw hat, fragile, do not handle, lift. They are beautiful, all knotted and decorated into many different designs.
And what strikes me most about the things I see here is that so much of what people used was made from straw.
It was a material that you could use to make anything. We've seating, we've lovely armchairs made out of straw.
They wove it into rope to make things like head rings to carry stuff on their heads. They also made all sorts of bags and baskets, as well as objects for their animals.
Muzzles for calves to stop them suckling, to wean them off the mother, you know, kind of everything made out of natural materials.
Everything that we're now using plastic and metals for.
They even made hen's nests. Beehive-shaped baskets to hold a single brooding hen to keep it safe from predators like foxes. And of course, people also made objects, talismans, to provide protection. In Ireland, one type in particular was popular.
This is our St. Bridget cross. This would be a press just full of Bridget cross.
There are hundreds of Bridget's crosses in here, dating back to the 19th century, carefully cosseted in acid-free paper. And some of them look so different to what we now consider as the traditional type.
Bridget cross can come in all different styles.
Jeez, they look like little sticks, like little lollipop sticks.
Exactly, like lollipop sticks, and just so simple. And
burnt,
just,
it's the decoration that burnt it into
is,
it.
Yeah, burning of crosses onto it.
It looks like something African or Ethiopian. These tiny spots, all sort of primitive looking spots and lines burnt into the rough sticks.
And that's from Lochinvar. Is it Lochinvar?
Lochinvara.
Galway. And then we have this one just from Teltown, County Meath. A simple wooden one. You know, so I suppose it's not this one here. County Mayo from Coonleffin, I think.
And with one stick Kilmaine. Split through the other stick.
Yeah,
to hold
so
it
everything, it's not, it, you can either have a wrapping or you're having a way of putting them together, or as you said, it's cleverly done, putting it stick through
so
stick.
Simple.
St. Bridget is generally associated with fertility, but she also provided protection. And I'm surprised to hear that people turn to her for protection against the evil eye, a concept I normally associate with Greek or Middle Eastern cultures.
Your friends and your neighbours mightn't have your best interests at heart, and you might actually be, you know, they might actually look with envy at your wonderful crop or your beautiful child, or, you know, especially your butter yield and how much, you know, your butter was coming in, and they might think, you have a lovely bit of butter there, but they might be thinking, they mightn't have said, God bless the work or the churning, and as a result, suddenly they're gone and your butter won't come anymore, your, you know, your cow dies, your crop fails, your child gets sick. And so as a result, it's all about protection, protection all the time, you know. And there's a sense of, as well, before electricity, there was such a sense of belief in the other world. And people were much more in tune with nature and the seasons, you know. And they also wanted to protect themselves from the fairies and the good people.
And all of this could be done by picking the right grasses and straws and weaving them in the right way.
Our ancestors also made bowls, baskets and boxes from willow and various woods and reeds and rushes. They crafted lobster pots from heather, bird traps from branches, carrying devices from cow hides. They even scattered rushes as a red carpet welcome for guests. And for important ceremonies and celebrations, they made straw effigies of St. Bridget and even straw costumes. These items were functional and efficient, but they were also incredibly beautiful, with an earthiness that somehow feels just right.
Yeah.
Look at all the colours of the different grasses.
Yeah.
Like there's blues and greens and browns.
We have straw objects that are 100 years old and they're bright and yellow and shiny and they never lost their colour. It's just that there's such a lustre to straw. But some of the natural materials, they, like the green rushes, sometimes the green will stay bright green, you know, and fresh looking.
When I look at these objects, I can almost feel something of the person who made them. That's not something you often get from a piece of plastic.
And they had that soft, crinkly sense to them. And every time you touched them, you knew you were wearing them away. They weren't built forever. Like, they're built for 20 or 30 years, and then the family would make them again.
Yeah.
And that sound is almost gone now. Now it's that the rubber of the plastic sound. So it's a homely...
It is, and I suppose the idea that you will always mend things. People mended things. They didn't let things just fall apart. Mm-hmm. So we would often have objects in our collection where there's a sense that it's been mended and remended. You know, traditional clothing is... It's very hard to have a traditional clothing collection because people never let things... They never gave things away. If it worked, it was handed down. It was handed down again. It was let out. Things were made much bigger, say, for children, so that they'd have massive kind of pleats in them, so that as the child grows, they grow into it. And then the other thing is that people had Sunday best and every day, but Sunday best became every day, became the rags, became used again, and just be cut up. So there's a sense that nothing went to waste, and people just used what they had.
And while I'm bowled over by the ingenious use of dried oat and barley stalks, Clodagh mentions she has something even more intriguing in a cupboard just a few feet away.
I'm just going to open this box here. No, this one here.
Bones, is it? Oh my God, hooves. Dirty, black and mouldy looking hooves. Good God, with some of the hair or the skin of the animal and cobwebs still on it.
That's it. These are our cow's legs. They're, you know, the tradition would have been that they would have stayed in the under thatch of the byre. Yeah. So an animal that had died of blackleg disease, the diseased part of the animal would often be cut off of the carcass and actually left in the byre with the other animals. And this was formed the protection and immunised the rest of the herd. So it actually made perfect veterinary sense. So you can see we have a lot of objects.
It's mummified, like it hasn't been preserved in any way. Skin and the flesh is still there, but just dried in the thatch.
That's it. And
that's eerie.
Sometimes the thatch roofs, though, you know, the byre would have had a fire, or they become another place where a fire might have been. So you'd find that there could be sooty. Yeah, there could be soot there.
The potency of these items and their ingenuity blows me away. I don't want to leave. I just want to immerse myself in the crafts and the skills that are secreted away inside every box. But there's one more thing I want to share with you before we have to leave the museum. Clodagh reaches into a cupboard and removes one of the custom-made boxes.
These other boxes hold pampooties, and I'm just going to open up the pampooties, which are their raw cow skin shoes. And I just think it's the idea of using everything from an animal. When a pig was killed, every single part of the pig was used. But in terms of, you can see these
aren't
are wonderful.
Beautiful. They look like little squirrel skins.
They do.
They are
and
brown.
You can see through them. They're actually, you know, these are hardened now, but they're cowskin shoes. They're made from one piece of cowskin, but with the hair still on it. And you can see that these are like a rectangular piece of skin has been used. And it's such a simple method. It's just you sew up the front mm-hmm. in one side and you sew up the back and you bring your string from the back to halfway and you bring your string from the front halfway, and that's your shoe made. And these were a children's pair, and you can see the colours and the cuteness of
beautiful.
Them. Aren't they wonderful?
Well, first they looked like the old shoes from Viking Dublin from
exactly.
the 9th century. But
we
these...
haven't changed too much. And you see, the thing is, these are shoes that were worn on the Aran Islands into the 1930s and 40s, and people were they were very good with that sort of, you can see the hair on them, that would have been good for gripping on wet rocks. And then every couple of months they'd have to make a new pair. But it's just that idea of making something, wearing animal skin as well, and wearing what you're, you know, using everything from an animal.
I did know that long ago we had a deep connection with the natural world, but this place brings home just how intense that interdependence was. This museum is like a handbook of tried and tested solutions to sustainable lives. And rather than being a romantic glimpse of more primitive times, I actually think it offers hints at an ecological future. You're listening to the A to Z of Ireland, where we're blazing an alphabetical trail through the wonders of our natural heritage. Leaving behind P for the potency and practicality of people at the Museum of Country Life in Mayo, let's move on to Q, which could be for quail, which used to arrive each summer to Ireland from Africa as commonly as swallows, and now are only found in a few fields in Kildare, if even there. Or Q for a queen bee, and the mystery of the one solo maiden flight she makes from the hive. Because during that flight, the queen bee somehow manages to find the male drones loitering in the vast skies above her, who are yearning to mate. But how does she do it? But instead, I think Q should be for quota, as in taking your allotted share. In this case, from Mother Nature. So I'm on my way to meet someone who distills the essence of the wild flowers and herbs from the hedgerows into some truly unusual vinegars. And what I really like about this story is that he's always careful to only take his share, his quota. He leaves the rest for his neighbours, the birds, mammals and insects, who also depend on the bounty of the hedgerow to survive. His name is Fiontán Gogarty, and he lives in a 16th century stone longhouse that he entirely rebuilt with his own hands from the rubble. It looks out over Lachlan Strand and Killala Bay. He's an artist, a forester, a former gallery owner, but his new passion is creating potions from the likes of samphire, fuchsia, meadowsweet and wild rose. And as soon as we get out of the car, he whisks me into a building opposite his own house to meet his mother.
So this is an old coach house, this is our old stable.
This was a stable.
Right. We put doors.
The building was converted by hand by Fiontán for vinegar making.
That's a fermenting kitchen,
is it? No, fermenting's here.
It feels medieval and even mysterious. There's a complex smell in the air, sharp and stimulating, and the walls are lined with wooden barrels and shelves filled with glassware. There's a sink in one corner.
So that's for like washing your veg and fruit that come.
This is clearly the place where Fiontán makes his vinegars. So you might be wondering, what's his mother doing here? And then,
look at this.
He opens the lid of a barrel filled with a musty, acrid, vibrant-smelling liquid.
Involved in it is this.
And he reaches in and grabs hold of
the vinegar mother. This lovely substance, which looks like a jellyfish.
Clearly not his birth mother, it's a vinegar mother. A slippery, slimy, gelatinous disc, the colour of ivory or of sour cream. And it's floating on top of the vinegar in a big barrel, like a soggy cloud. It's essentially a starter culture for kicking off the process of vinegar making.
Yes, what happens is that your vinegar mother will convert, after the fermentation is finished, your vinegar mother will convert alcohol to acetic acid.
Okay.
In much the same way as you put in, an active ingredient in with yogurt.
Yeah.
You know, you put your active yogurt in and then that starts the whole process.
So the mother is this, it looks like a jellyfish, like a very thick jellyfish, or a bit of cloth almost.
Almost.
Is it alive?
Oh, it's alive, yeah. I mean, vinegar mother is a living thing.
And what is it? So it's bacteria?
It's bacteria.
It a microorganism?
It's a microorganism, yeah.
And it's, so
naturally, it will form. I mean, if you, for example, were to take some fruit juice.
Yeah.
And just leave it outside on a warm day, cover it with some muslin, and not put in any vinegar, mother. And you let fruit flies get it, uh-huh. at it. Fruit flies have vinegar, mother, on their legs.
No.
Yeah. And that's how the whole fermentation and whole thing starts anyway. That's a very primitive way. So if you want to develop your own mother, mm-hmm. that's a great way to do it. It's just let the fruit flies get it.
But then, like, you'll have the vinegar made in a few weeks or a few months. What'll happen to the mother then till next year? She'll have more gorse?
Well, no, the mother, it's, you feed the mother.
All
you
year.
Put the mother into...
Where's the mother? Your mother is in this pot.
Fiontán moves over to a shelf and takes down a glass jar, one that you might find a preserved skull or a monkey fetus in.
What have you done to your mother, Fiontán?
And he opens it.
Oh my God, look at the jelly on that. Holy Mary.
Yes, so you
that's
feed,
like some alien species.
You feed a vinegar mother, and that's how you keep it going.
And who's so that's not a gorse mother? Is that a mother of another of an elderflower?
No, that's my gorse mother. Look.
Oh, look at that.
It's clearly alive, but like no plant or animal you can think of. As if a sodden, straggly dishcloth or sponge was able to eat and replicate.
So you have a mother for every single wild plant or herb that you pick?
Yep. And you feed them. If you don't look after them, it's a bit like the sheep. Don't feed the sheep. They won't be there next year. So you need to keep your mother going all the time.
And is this something ancient or is this something new?
No, it's something ancient. Something ancient. It's exactly the same kind of principle of it being things. These things are discovered by accident. Someone wanted to transport milk once upon a time. Mm-hmm. Thought, well, I'll rinse out the sheep's bladder, carry it in the sheep's, you know, sheep's stomach rather.
Yeah.
And of course, by the time they got to their destination, what was it? But a cottage cheese.
Oh.
Because of the rennet in
the sheep's bladder.
So the sheep's stomach.
We use this thing from the stomach of an animal still to make cheese.
So, but it's a perfect container to carry something. If you didn't have glass or you didn't have ceramics.
Yeah.
So these things you discover by accident.
I'm excited by this idea of culinary accidents and also amazed by how many different types of flowers and wild herbs Fiontán gathers to make his vinegars. As we head outside to sit in the sun, he mentions samphire and sloes, water mint and wild mountain thyme, meadowsweet and heath, fig and fuchsia.
So is your wish in making these vinegars to capture the absolute taste of a wild plant?
Yes, and that's what people actually say to me. That's just pure elderflower. Oh God, my God, that's well, some of them say, so that's what heather tastes like, because they've never tasted heather.
So it's almost this, you know, if there was this fanatic craze in Paris for the distillation of smells in perfume, and, you know, it was a whole new concept to be able to distill the essence of something. So, but we never thought, we didn't have those sophisticated things in Ireland in the 17th, 18th century. So the idea of actually distilling the essence of the hedgerow, of a particular flower, is a new concept to us.
No, it's a forgotten concept to us. I've forgotten the name of the Roman writer, but he, writing around the 3rd century, he had incredible praise for the heather beer that the Irish were producing. So, heather was in our culinary lexicon way back, and then we lost it. I suppose losing Gaelic Ireland and losing, and then having things like the Elizabethan plantation where hops and all kinds of things were introduced to Ireland, the Irish cuisine vanished, disappeared, and we only have kind of little written pieces about it. Whereas in other European cultures, it continued to, it stayed there, it thrived, it grew. And that's the wonderful thing about Irish food at the moment, is that it's evolving and growing in, you know, at a rate you don't see elsewhere in Europe. And it's a big melting pot that's all going in there, and wonderful things come out of it.
When it comes to harvesting, Fiontán is more like a hunter-gatherer than a farmer. For him, it's not about maximising gain, but working in harmony with nature, which means knowing when to take from a plant without inflicting harm. By synchronising with their growth cycle and only harvesting a little, you can actually help a plant and ensure a dependable supply indefinitely.
Elderflower is a very good one, because if you harvest too much elderflower in the spring, you're not going to get any elderberries in the winter. So, you know, there are stretches of elderflower that I leave alone and don't touch, because I'll go back to those in the autumn. You know, and I'm conscious that, you know, the birds have to have their share, and the insects have to, and pollination is so important as well. So you have to strike a balance. It's not a big industry, you know. It's a love of doing it as well.
You realise how rare that is. So, like, first people settled in this island and they were hunter-gatherers, and then farmers came and they learned how to exploit crops. They'd plant crops for their own need and for their own good, and they were in control. What you're doing, you're going back to that hunter-gatherer thing. You rely on what's wild that's out there. Like, you can't plant nice rows of gorse or elderflower. At least you're not. You're going out and depending, basically, that idea of gathering what you need.
That's part of it. But one of the things that we started last year was, because I get so much free, if you like, from nature in terms of the harvest from the hedgerow, we put 7 acres into a mixture of oats and linseed.
To harvest these oats and linseed?
No, you don't harvest them. You plant 7 acres of oats and linseed.
Why?
The birds eat them all winter.
No.
Yeah.
You're farming for the birds.
No, it's not just the birds. If you think about it, you put these 7 acres in.
Yeah.
But then, because it's not harvested, the seed heads fall to the ground and you have mice and you have voles. Therefore, you have raptors, you have owls, you have kestrels, you have sparrowhawks. This year we'd buzzards back. So it's giving something back. Because I harvest from the hedgerow, so the very least I can do is give something back. Because I'm taking some of their food.
The idea of giving nature its share sounds so utopian now. But that's how we always did it, until relatively recently. So Fiontán is merely reminding us of some old and wise insights. And in the process, he's developing products that capture wild tastes to enliven our meals.
And that's what vinegars are for. They're about enhancing and transforming food. And the more natural flavours that you can bring to that. I mean, how else do you bring, you know, fuchsia or heather or gorse to your food, other than you can do it in a salad. You can take the blossom and you can, you know, have it in a salad and it's fabulous. But you can't do that in December. But if you have a gorse vinegar, you can.
Nice, nice. It's like the alchemy of the hedgerow.
Yes.
Stuff. Great, thank you for that. I want to try some.
You're listening to the A to Z of Ireland, an alphabetical road trip to visit some of Ireland's best natural heritage. And for the last 3 nights, we've been tasting, smelling, watching and listening to Wild Ireland. We've just finished up with the letter Q for quota, which brings us on to LMNOPQR. R, which I think should stand for remembering. You see, one of the great things about travelling in Ireland, regardless of how you travel, is getting lost. It means you get to see things you wouldn't otherwise. Or, if you're like me and you travel around a bit, it means you get to remember things that you thought you'd forgotten. Which is exactly what happened when the producer Colette and I were driving around the Burren. We got lost in the labyrinth of tiny roads, and it sparked an almost forgotten memory of a man who lived somewhere nearby. The sort of semi-mythical figure you're not quite sure you dreamt of or actually met. And what I liked about this man is that he occupied that hazy liminal zone between civilization and wilderness.
Okay, so where are we now, Mancon?
We're sort of lost, which isn't like a bad thing to be in the Burren, like on a beautiful day coming in from the east. If you come in from the coast,
you just know, you see the Atlantic Ocean, then you know to head east at some point. We're coming from Galway. Now, I don't think it's, there's a windy road up there, and I know I was once up that road. There was an old man, he's dead now, an old bachelor, lived entirely on his own in, it's not even fair to say a house, more like in a shed. But he milked goats, like the wild Burren goats that lived up on Mullaghmore, up on the mountains. He was able to milk them. You see, he was wild himself, okay? So he never left the area. He never had a car, never had a tractor. He had a sister-in-law and a brother who'd, like, every 2 years would go into Ennis or Carrafin and buy him some clothes and bring them up to him. And then he, in return, would give some of this milk, and then his brother would sell it in either Carrafin or Boston or Ina. And that was how he made his living. Like, I think he was there, oh, I don't know, until about 6 years ago. And now it's tragic. His house is just... This house, it's not a house, it's a shed. It's just the remains.
One of the things I like a lot about Irish culture is the connection, the rootedness that Irish people have to the land. It's been like this for more than 9,000 years. Our earliest pre-Christian ancestors even went so far as to revere the earth and nature as a sacred entity. We were an animistic society, believing in the god of every raindrop, every oak branch and beech pebble. And we worshipped it with rituals right throughout the year. Until gradually that visceral connection to the land was weakened with the arrival of foreign ideas and beliefs. Christianity, trade, taxes, imports, money. In recent years, though, people have become interested in reviving the old traditions and reconnecting with the land and the elements. On the Hill of Uisneach in Westmeath, people now gather again in early May for the Bealtaine Festival, which is an ancient springtime fertility rite. They connect with the earth through music, drumming and simple ceremonies, all around a vast central bonfire. And it all revolves around what's known as Eil na Muireann, or the Catstone. I asked the local guide, Marty Mulligan, to tell me about it.
Uisneach is at the centre of Ireland, and people would have said that it was the exact precise centre of Ireland, that the Catstone marked the exact centre of Ireland. We're not sure about that, but we know that it is the sacred centre of Ireland. And Uisneach is the inner circle of Ireland, and it represents the navel of Ireland.
And so is that as much a spiritual thing as a physical thing, or a psychological thing almost?
All. This is what makes it so unique, because it's physically, this plateau sits 600 feet above sea level in the centre of Ireland. So physically we are at the centre of Ireland. Spiritually, most ancient cultures, and I happen to meet many people from all over the world now, they all come here from all different native peoples, from Native American, Hawaii, African, Australian. All these native cultures have the same idea of the centre. So the idea of centrality was so important that you'd come to the centre, and it was said that all roads lead to Uisneach and all roads lead from Uisneach. So you come to the centre, you get yourself centred, and then you find your true direction, north, south, east, west. Once you're centred, you can do that.
And it had a role in growing, in fertility too?
Absolutely, because it's all about Bealtaine. Different sites in the country represent different times in the calendar of the year. The astronomical calendar is a circular calendar, and there are 8 different sections in that calendar. And there's your quarter periods and cross-quarter periods, and therefore you get the seasons. So each season was marked at different sites. And Uisneach represents Bealtaine, which is the mouth of the fire, which is the summer. It's bringing in the summertime. So summer was the big event, the big occasion. You've survived the dark winter, you've survived the cold spring, now you're into the bright suntime, and it's all about the fertility of the land and the fertility of the people. The tribes from each province would assemble at their own sites first, Rathcrohan in Galway, Armacha in Armagh, Donegal in Kildare, Tara, and Cashel in Munster. All of the tribes would assemble and then make their journey to Uisnech for the great celebrations of Gaeltacht. It's worshipping nature and agriculture and understanding the seasons, when to reap and when to sow and when to harvest.
And it's this fire ceremony that is now being recreated every year on the hill of Uisnech, about halfway between Mullingar and Athlone. It's a heady experience of a few thousand people. Many of them dress in ceremonial gear and slowly climb the hill in a procession of drummers and dancers, druids and diviners, with fire beacons lighting the way. The crowd is remarkably diverse. Older local people who still remember when the rhythms of nature were honoured in the past, mixing with city folk who wish to reconnect with the old customs and culture, and families whose children are transfixed by the fires, the swirling flags and the banners, and the white horses that flank the procession. It's a modern celebration, but it makes you feel what our ancestors would have felt long ago.
Why didn't we know about this when we were growing up?
Uisnech was almost like forgotten about, because things changed once Christianity came to this country and people stopped coming to sites like these and worshipping nature. It would be frowned upon to visit a site, a sacred pagan site as such.
What is that connection between the fire and the soil? So is that about growth? Is that...
Absolutely. There's a practical in all of their ceremonies. The ceremonies of each period of the eight periods in the calendar year were marked by fire ceremonies. It represents that Mother Earth is awake, that now is this time, the summertime is here. And the fires acted as a beacon, because from the highest point at Uisnech, the fires, you can see 20 counties on a clear day from Uisnech. So the fires would, like the beacon fires in Lord of the Rings, spread, and instantly in Tara they would know that now the fire is lit. Then it spread nationwide. The country was plunged into darkness on the eve of Gaeltacht. All fires extinguished until the Uisnech fire was lit. Once that's lit, all other fires lit. So you're rekindling and just rebirthing and you're reawakening the earth's energies, because they felt that the heat from the fires would help heat up the earth, heat up the land, because sometimes it's too cold at the beginning of May, you could have some frostbite. So this will help physically heat up, and that the earth's energies will feel the heat and think it must be the sun. It's that time of the year again. You're alive, you've survived it. Neighbour would meet neighbour, they would have hibernated. This was the time then to trade, to politics would be discussed, of course. This was the great assembly.
Will you join us?
People literally took the fire home with them by lighting a type of dense fungus that smoulders rather than burns. This way, the sacred essence of Uisnech was in their hearts all year. It's hard to underestimate the potency of these rituals. We forget what we lost when we shifted our attention from the earth as a god to Christianity, when we brought our ceremonies from outside in nature into stone churches. So maybe this bonfire is just exactly what we need right now, to remind us that nature really is at the centre of everything. You're listening to the A to Z of Ireland, an alphabetical journey through natural heritage. We've just left S for the sacred bonfire of Uisnech, and it's time to search for tea. And what immediately comes to mind is tea for Tony, the remarkable Tony Louth. A Dubliner I first met last year in the ruins of an abandoned car park in the Liberties of Dublin. He's a man who understands better than anyone I know the intimate bond between humans and the earth, specifically soil. And right in the middle of Dublin, behind the National College of Art and Design, Tony has created a minor miracle. He's managed to make a productive community vegetable garden on an abandoned site using compost that he made from scraps and leaves and waste that he gathers from all across the city. Tony is somebody you need to meet.
I'm about two blocks up from the River Liffey on the quays in Dublin, walking down a street just behind Thomas Street. And there's a big car park, Thomas Street car park. On my right and my left are social housing from, I don't know, it looks like the 1930s. And there's an old abandoned lot, a former car park with big railings around it and posters stuck up to the railings for Nashville in Concert, for Michael Bolton. And inside one of the gates, I drag, if I can find the right entrance to this, yeah, this gate gets dragged open, and I'm inside in a realm of Budley. It says NCAD, Community Garden. And this is the realm where Tony Louth, a retired businessman, is creating compost to create a garden. So I'm continuing up the hill, and it's the hill for what was a flat car park. This is an amazingly steep hill to climb through a wood of Budleia. But then beyond the Budleia appears this soaring mound of leaves, of branches, of rotted straw and hay, of manure from the horses and jarvies, an old flattened wheelbarrow, grass clippings. And what I want to find out from Tony is how all of this is being transformed into the finest, most nutritious soil and earth by worms, by nothing more than the constant action of a whole army, a whole battalion, a whole civilization of worms underneath this soil. And there's Tony with his bags. Busy Tony. How are you, Tony? Constant bags.
Tony, a ruddy-featured, stocky figure with a grey beard, is constantly at work, shoveling, wheeling his wheelbarrow, or gathering waste. I actually have to run to keep up with him, but I finally catch him at a corner of the site beneath a supermarket with vast cooling fans that drone constantly. Although this doesn't seem to bother Tony or his beloved worms, as it's one of the most vibrant and fruitful spots in the whole garden.
Surrounding me are raised beds of every type of potato, of kale, of cabbage, of broad beans, of, is that celery, of angelica, comfrey, long lines of comfrey, and this huge heap of rotting brown soil, of incredibly rich looking compost.
So don't forget the garlic.
Oh, and the garlic, Tony, yeah. So yeah, Tony, what are you doing here?
What I'm doing is farming compost and putting in a no-dig garden.
And what does that entail?
That entails making huge amounts of compost from raw materials sourced locally and making a big pile and letting nature do its work, okay? And it which takes about 2 years, and then you know it's ready when the brandling worms, which are the small worms, migrate to your next compost heap.
So explain that. Does these brandling worms are in the soil naturally, are they?
Yes. They'll find anything that's rotting, okay? Leaves, apples, anything. Veg waste, anything that's rotting.
Where are the worms? I see this is all based on this concept of worms, and when you're here, you see everything else, but you don't see worms.
You don't see worms because they're underneath the surface. They don't like.
Look
to
at
be
that. Tony's
the,
just
the
dug
light.
Up. Just dug
they
up.
Don't like the light.
How did you know they were there? You've just dug up a tiny fraction, like a basically 4 inches of soil, and there are tiny little brown worms, which I haven't noticed before. So they're very different from the earthworm, the artichoke.
Yes, they're big. They're different from the larger worm.
Yeah. And as you say, they are everywhere.
They're everywhere, and they double their population, I'd say, once every 2 months. So there's huge increases all the time.
Yeah.
In here.
Sometimes you would have handfuls.
So did you say what? Sometimes you would have handfuls.
You'd have handfuls of them. They'd like worm nests. They form a kind of a nest.
So you've actually created a reserve for the idea. And Tony's just going to scratch another bit of soil there. And there's wood lice.
Yeah.
So in some ways, like, for you, this is, you're making compost, but this is also like a reserve for worms. It's the ideal situation for worms.
Absolutely.
And as you say, you're bringing in so much outside good. You're bringing in leaf mould, you're bringing in vegetables and the horse
coffee
manure. And what did you say?
Coffee grinds. Oh. Coffee grinds from 8 restaurants.
And that's all being created into compost?
All being created into compost, because the worms particularly love coffee grinds. They provide grit, I think, to the worm. But everywhere you see them, you'll notice the worms proliferate.
Is that what you're doing? In a way, you're sort of farming worms as part of the thing.
Yeah, you're farming compost, and which is actually you and using your workers are the worms. So you have millions of workers here all the time. And that's the beauty of it. It's like an automatic process that just carries on and on and on. And it's wonderful to watch. And nature comes in. There's a lot of wild bird population comes here. Sparrows, blackbirds, other types of birds. They love it here. We would have colonies of blackbirds.
Attracted by the worms again.
Attracted by the worms because they'd be scratching and eating. And there's enough for everybody.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And so it's not a sense that you're often, you know, farming is exploiting animals, but you don't. It's not exploiting worms. You're just creating the ideal conditions.
We're creating the ideal conditions, and then I passionately believe that in work, that work provides for need and stops vice. So I think this is, my ambition now would be to develop this. This is a pilot to be developed into an organic centre, our community agricultural project, okay? And then to build an integration centre, to give people a home away from home.
Tony's belief in inner city food production is multi-layered. It provides meaningful work for local young people, getting them off the streets or out of their flats. It also produces beautiful and affordable veg in areas that don't have it. And Tony himself knows that working with the land can ease stress and offer relief from the chaos of urban life. He also wants to promote organic horticulture. After a lifetime of landscape gardening, Tony knows that you do not need chemical fertilizers or pesticides. His garden is based on the no-dig system, which entails using hot compost, like the type that he's making here, to enrich the soil. Hot compost kills the weeds and the pests, so you never have to dig or till the ground much. It means you can grow a lot of food without all that much work. A garden like this, he hopes, will inspire others to take over abandoned areas and use them for food production. At the heart of a good society, Tony believes, is a tight-knit community with an appreciation of nature and its bounty. All of this can be facilitated with the help of wriggling worms and decomposing waste matter.
And I believe that the no-dig system, if developed right, actually, could produce vast amounts of food for the city. We're putting in chemicals and harvesting. I think it's a myth that we can't feed the world from natural resources.
Yeah.
And when you look around at the kale, chard, peas, onions, beetroot, carrots and courgettes, you see what Tony means. You could probably feed 2 or 3 inner city blocks from this car park alone, which is only about the size of a soccer pitch. And people from the area get involved too. They bring their own kitchen waste here and then come back to buy or to barter for vegetables.
We're encouraging people to take a box and take it away, and we give them these free boxes, plastic buckets with a lid on it, and they bring back their veg waste, and then they get a fresh bucket. and we appreciate the waste. And nature appreciates the waste. And this is what we should all be doing.
So rather than this waste being people paying to have it taken away, you will take it for free and you will put it to use.
Well, and we will put it to good use. Because that's social economy. It was social economy when I was young to go to the beach and pick up the clinkers, which was the spent coal from the steamships. That provided our heat. So timber that floated in off the ships was burnt. So nothing was wasted. My mother knitted. Everybody did something. You know, the family was a unit, okay, I mean, and there was always production going on.
Right.
So everybody felt their usefulness.
At the beginning, people just didn't think that Tony could turn a car park into a farm like this one. Even so-called urban renewal groups or horticulture experts were sceptical.
And the power of the statement that your biggest, your most active compost heap is right up against the wall of, did you say this is Lidl? So that noise we're hearing is Lidl.
It's Lidl.
So it's two things. Your Lidl with this buzzing sound is going around, where at the same time you're showing an alternative. The alternative that we actually must go back to if we want a future.
I think so. And this is what I'm doing to do. People can come here and they can replicate this.
Mm-hmm.
And we could have every derelict site. This was totally degraded land. It was a car park. So we had to move stones, buddleia. We had to rake the top of it off, okay, to put in the beds. So it's a win-win situation for a city.
You've created what looks like a forest floor and that is growing the freshest, most vibrant vegetables I've ever seen.
And it creates work for people. Yeah. To me, this is the problem in cities, that we have no work for people. We have to go back to a system where work pays. And this is something that I strive for, to build something where people can work and enjoy life, okay, I mean, and have a bountiful supply of vegetables and have work.
Yeah. Now, what you're doing here, Tony, what you and the worms and the woodlice and everything is doing here, it's inspirational, it really is. Thank you for that. I'll let you get back to your compost.
Okay.
I appreciate it, Tony.
No.
And here we are, almost at the end of this leg of our alphabetical journey to Ireland's natural heritage. We started with P for people, hearing about the myriad ways our ancestors used nature to meet their everyday needs. And then we wandered all the way through to T for Tony, who harnessed the power of nature to create a vibrant and fertile community garden in central Dublin. But this journey ain't over yet. We have one more road to travel. So do join us for the next episode, the final stage of this alphabet trail through the magic of Wild Ireland, where we'll meet underground bears, X-rated orchids, and medieval zombies. But for now, though, there's just about time for one more story from Beezy, who we met right back at the start of the programme. Beezy is the keeper of many of the old rural traditions of the village of Fore in County Westmeath, where people use things from nature to either protect themselves or curse others.
I remember years ago as a child too, going to the national school, and I remember the man that buried the eggs in the corners of the field for a neighbour. They had a row or something. They were neighbours and they had a neighbouring land and they fell out over who should fence the ditch or something like that. And the other man buried eggs in the four corners of the fields.
And what effect did it have, burying the eggs in the field?
Well, the man himself got a heart attack and was in hospital for months, and everything, I think everything he had died, I think all the animals, I think everything died. He was left with nothing. And he came home, and I remember he coming in to my mother. My mother was an invalid, and I remember he, after coming out of hospital, and he was shook, sure, he was hardly able to walk at the time, but he lived for a good few years afterwards.